Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Runner's World podcast with me, Rick Pearson.
Me, Ben Hobson.
And me, Jane Maguire.
Today we're speaking with 800-metre ace Elliot Giles. So, talking with a proper athlete today. Quite exciting.
Are you casting dispersions immediately about our previous guest, Rick?
Talk about throwing shade in the first 30 seconds.
We've had some excellent runners on. We've had some amazing runners before.
I don't think we've had a track star, though.
Not a track star for possibly ever, or certainly for a while. But he's, I guess a lot of people remember Elliot Giles. He broke Seb Coe's 800 metre indoor record earlier this year, and it was just sort of like a real like breakthrough performance for him. Really exciting to speak with him, and as listeners will discover, his way of training is proper mavericking, I would say.
Yeah.
He's a genuine maverick.
He just swims everywhere. There's no running.
No swimming, but it's a lot of
close.
It's a lot of elliptico work.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
My shock and surprise to all this is because I wasn't part of the interview with Rick when Rick and Jane did this. So this is all new to me too, listeners. So I'm being told trade secrets as you're hearing them too. Come on then, what else did he do?
Well, I won't do too much of a spoiler, but I think this is headline stuff. So he's an elite 800 meter runner, and the people he's racing against are ordinarily putting together weeks that I reckon are probably between sort of 60 and 80 miles a week. So quite fairly big mileage. Guess how many miles a week Elliot Giles runs?
You've set this up for me to just say 30.
To undermine.
30.
15.
What?
15 miles. He does three runs a week. Just three runs.
Okay.
Yeah. No long running, no long slow running. And he's absolutely one of the best people in the world. And it's just remarkable, I think. And I'm really inspiring to hear that you can compete on your own terms and you're doing things your own way if you kind of work with your body and what you're good at.
I have one question. How far does an 800 meter runner... What constitutes a long run for an 800 meter runner?
I think that a lot of 800 meter runners will be doing a kind of between a sort of 12 to 15 mile long run, something like that.
Wow. Okay, that's longer than I thought. Interesting. Okay.
Mm. Yeah, but not Elliot. He's out there on the elliptico, beasting himself on the elliptico.
Yeah, going up and down the hills.
So he goes. He does hill work on the elliptical.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I mean, I like these stories because I'm not a high mileage kind of runner, but I haven't done any racing or achieved any greatness. But also, I don't think my body responds well to it. So yeah. It's always nice to hear. Like, I know that Sophie Power, she was, when we had her on and she talked about her training for the UTMB. I mean, this was postpartum, so that was in effect, but I think even before then she was sort of saying that when she was training for ultras she would max out at, I think it was 30 miles a week.
Yeah, it wasn't big miles. Yeah, it was something,
and it
like
was all the
like
rest
that,
of it was all cross training and things like that, and it's good to hear, like, because you know a lot of running, marathon training, anything distance related tends to always double down on like big mile weeks. You've got to be racking up these big old, my training week last week I did 70 miles. Ho, look at me. You know, there's that bravado with it. So it's always interesting to hear when someone goes like, I'm an elite athlete and I did 15 miles every week going to go to the Olympics. See you later. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah, totally. And he was, he's a very, very nice, charismatic bloke as well. So it's great to chat to him. And without giving away too many other secrets, I think we should go and talk to our guest of the week. Guest of the week. Here in the studio. Guest of the week. Sometimes on the phone. Could be an athlete. Could be a physio. Or a complete unknown. Our guest this week holds the British record for the 800 metres indoors and is one of Team GB's medal hopefuls at the Tokyo Olympics this summer. But what makes his story even more remarkable is that back in 2014, he was involved in a terrible motorbike accident that left him barely able to walk. Here to talk about running, recovery and unusual training methods, it's Elliot Giles. So welcome to the Runner's World podcast.
Hello, hello.
Great to have you on. Could we start with where and when your running journey began?
I started running just as I left school. So I was 16. I got fed up with playing other sports and just decided to try my hand at running. I went down to the local running club, got turned away on the first approach. And luckily my first coach Eddie gave me a shot and took me under his wing, and it sort of blossomed from there.
So they turned you away. That seems like, that's a bit like kind of not signing the Beatles, isn't it? It seems like a weird decision from a running club. What's that about?
Oh, I'll take that as a massive compliment. I'm not quite there yet. But no, so at Birchfield, they have, they're quite strict on who they let in and who they don't let in, because they're quite a big club and they have sort of quite a long waiting list. But I just figured if I don't try my luck, I'll never find out. And luckily, as I was turned away by the people at the registration desk, my to-be coach was walking past and said, no, I'll take him on, just let him come with me and I'll give him a trial. And yeah, we sort of hit it off from there.
That's amazing. So actually, that's quite late, isn't it, to kind of take running seriously? Because I guess a lot of people that you'd be up against would be people who, you know, joined the club age, you know, 6 or 7, but you actually got into it when you were 16.
Yeah, it's all relative, isn't it? I mean, I played other sports. I always kept fit. I guess I just didn't quite push my body to the realms of sort of you do in training, but I always kept fit. I always played every sport I could, and and then I took my hand to running fairly late. Well, very late in terms of being a professional athlete, I guess. But I actually think if I joined any earlier, I probably wouldn't have continued, because I got bored of so many different sports that I might not have been running at this point if I went any earlier.
How old were you when you had your accident, and can you talk about that and what happened and how that kind of affected you?
So I was, how old was I now? It's 2014, so I was about 21. Was I 21? I was about, no, I wasn't 21. I was about 19 or 20, one of the two. Sorry, I should know that, but I can't even think. I was 19 or 20. And yeah, in short, it was, at the time I was only running, I think my personal best was, so I was 19. My personal best was roughly 1:53. So I wasn't even, I guess you could argue that I wasn't even really considered to be an athlete, because 1:53 didn't even get you an invitation to British Champs. And I was 19 at the time. But prior to that, I was actually injured for about three years. So I started running at 16. I ran for about a year and a half to 2 years. And I then spent, did I even run for a year? I was pretty much injured for so long. I mean, wow. The majority of my start of my running career is so checkered that a lot of it was actually spent on the sidelines, because in my first year, I managed to get an England best when I turned 17. And then 17, 18 and 19 were all injury years. And then it wasn't until after the crash. So the crash actually came after my period of injury, and the crash sort of allowed me to sort of rebuild, regather myself and build up slowly through the help of James Brewer. He was based at Twickenham St. Mary's at my university. And he's largely the reason why I was able to put the pieces to the puzzle together, because he kind of slowed me down. Whereas prior to that, it was kind of get injured, run for 6 weeks, get injured, run for 6 weeks. And I've got like a Word document that shows it all. And it's, I think over the course of like a few months, the amount of training I'd done, when I look back, sometimes I do think, I don't know how I'm here where I am now, because of how little training I was able to accumulate over the years, which is why I think my performances of late have improved so much, because I only knew what doggy determination was. I didn't really know what consistency was, because I was injured so often. And it's only been sort of the last year that I actually had a full years of training, and I was able to come out at the indoors. And it was the only winter I've never had an injury. In fact, no, wow. Sorry, I had about 15 days off in total over the winter, but that's the only winter I've never really picked up an injury. And to only miss 15 days throughout the course of a winter was kind of showed why I ran as well as I did indoors, because it kind of hasn't ever happened before, which was quite nice to actually experience. Yeah. That
I think that's a really inspiring story for all our listeners, because I think we've all kind of gone into that endless cycle of injury, but for you the I guess the positive of the accident was that you actually stopped and you started again. But how bad were those injuries that you sustained that you kind of had to start again from? Are we talking you couldn't walk, or are we talking kind of broken bones?
So when I had the crash, it was a 3-lane road in Birmingham city centre. I was picking up my younger brother from a rugby training. And I was in the left lane. It was heading up to the mailbox. The roads have all changed around that area now, so it's all completely different. But there was a 3-lane road leading up to the traffic lights. I was in the first lane. There was a lady in the third lane, in the right lane, and she missed her turning off to the Crown Plaza. And she sort of realised she missed her turning, decided to do a late manoeuvre, jumped one lane, jumped the second lane, but didn't realise I was coming up to go past the lights. As she sort of came across, she kind of sideswiped. My little brother went over the top of the bike. I was sort of trapped in between the bike and the car because where she hit me, my knee was sort of wedged in between. So I was sort of taken off to the side. I landed on the side of a curb. So I damaged all my lower back. And then I hit my head off a bollard. So I was knocked out, fortunately. And even now, I can only give you what I've seen on CCTV and what my little brother remembers. But my injuries, my little brother was okay. He was unscathed, but he woke up and saw big bro sort of knocked out, and was for him, it was pretty sketchy and scary. But for me, it was pretty chill because I kind of woke up just in pain in the hospital. My lower back just had sort of like the bruising on my lower back. It almost felt like my back wasn't a part of me, and I tore my PCL and ruptured my glute. And then I had brain damage as well. But even now, my glute is still sort of deformed. It kind of makes like I can't describe it. Where it detached from the muscle, it kind of, as it's reattached, it's kind of like a ball instead of like a curved shape. It kind of has like a hunch in it. But yeah, my PCL sort of sorted itself out because I spent 3 weeks bedbound afterwards. It was tough, but again, it kind of made me, I always think when you go through forms of adversity, it kind of just shapes your character, and it kind of shows you what you can achieve. If you can go through the downs, the highs are the easy part.
You seem like a really positive person, Elliot, but was it mentally quite tough to go through an experience like that? And did you kind of worry that, you know, your running career might not happen after that?
Don't be fooled. I mean, I at the time I went through what I felt like was hell, and it was the worst period of my life that I've ever experienced. I was, because my head was such a mess and I suffered brain damage. I didn't really understand what was going on. I couldn't move out of bed for 3 weeks. I remember having to wee in a milk bottle out the side because I physically couldn't get up. I didn't actually go to the toilet for number two for 3 weeks. So I had like constant constipation. And then when you have like trapped wind, and then I'm kind of wincing, and every time I wince, I couldn't crouch because my back was hurting so much. And then every time my knee moved, it felt like it was going to fall off. And because the nerves were all damaged, and I had no sort of sensation in like my lower back and my right side. And yeah, it was pretty tough, because I remember going through one period where it was probably about 2 weeks in, and I just felt so down and out that my hands started peeling. And I remember it was literally like a snake. I could peel the skin off my hands, and I don't know what that caused. I can only put that down to some form of sort of heightened depression or something like that, because I'd never experienced sort of a low like it. It'd be wrong to say I was an athlete back then. I mean, my PB was 1:53. I was on the back of constant injuries anyway. I kind of knew that if I got through that period that I would be able to sort of be an athlete. And I always believed that I could be one of the best. I just never had the opportunity to prove it. And I guess after that, those 3 weeks in bed, I kind of knew that running was easy, really. I just had to take it slowly, and sort of standing on the start line, and when you're fit is the easy part, but the dark days are where that shapes the champions, I think.
Do you think that mindset, kind of, you say you weren't an athlete, but you definitely were, do you think that mindset helped you through the dark days, and to have that goal of being able to run again got you through that patch?
Yeah, I think I was just a young, stupid kid that wouldn't take no. I wasn't willing to be told no to a certain extent. And it's kind of like the one where it's almost like I've recently picked up a little bit of an injury now, and it's the first injury I've had in quite a while. And I think my problem is that like I've picked up this problem with my quad, and in my head, it's like my body's telling me no, but then the other side of me saying, no, I can get through this. So my problem is that I'm also, my superpower is also my biggest downfall. And because I'm willing to push through the pain, I often make problems out of nothing when I should just stop, because I know I can get through it, and because my mind tells me I can get through anything, that's probably my biggest downfall. But again, it's my biggest superpower when I step on the start line, because I'm more than willing to go through the pain. But that pain can't be mixed with injury. So again, there's pros and cons to having that mindset, and it helps in some ways, but other ways it is a downfall. But again, which is why I only run so limited now, and I don't do many miles, and I only sort of run three, four days, absolute max a week.
Wow. Can we talk about your training method? Because I think that's incredible to hear that from like an elite athlete, that you might run 3 or 4 days a week. How have you adjusted it, and how does it work for you? Tell us a little bit about your approach to training.
So in summary, I just do 3 sessions a week, and then I might do like a drill session around it. I don't do any runs anymore. I've stopped doing runs completely. And I've stopped that for the last year or so. And it's largely because I've torn my calf every year, at least 3 times every year up until last year. And it was so repetitive. It was almost annoying, because I just kept tearing my calves. I kept having Achilles issues, and then something had to break. So I had to figure out a way to train, because I knew that I didn't need the training to be able to compete at the world level in terms of the running load. I knew I didn't need to do the same as the other guys. So I needed to figure out a way that I could get consistency, because consistency trumps talent every single time, in my opinion. And that way was to just focus on the sessions and top up the rest of it with cross training as and around. And I've realized that at last year, largely, although it was COVID, and there was lockdown, I was able to sort of just limit my training to 3 days a week, 4 as a top up. And I just became consistent. And when you're training for sort of 6 weeks back to back, and 6 weeks become 6 months, I was kind of doing stuff in training, and I was kind of just like, I'm not fatigued, I'm not tired, I'm not feeling like my Achilles is going to snap or my calf's going to snap. It was the first year I actually ran pain-free and wasn't considering like, am I going to get through the race or am I going to finish the session? And it was actually quite nice, and it was quite enjoyable to race without being in pain. And then I realized that through just doing 3 to 4 days a week, I could be sort of a real contender. And then I had a half decent year last year, and then the indoors was just like a whole different thing, because we didn't do anything different other than was consistent. That was all. I mean, I didn't expect to run as quick as I did during the indoors. I knew that I was more consistent than I'd ever been. And I think the consistency on top of everything I'd built as those foundations just really rocketed me forward.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's absolutely amazing that, because I talked to Jake Whiteman a year ago and talked about his training. He was talking about, you know, going out and doing, you know, 12, 15 mile long runs, 80 mile weeks, probably running 5 or 6 times a week, maybe more. But your approach is like the complete other end of the spectrum. And I think it's really refreshing to hear that it can be extremely successful and actually to work with the body you've got rather than to try to fit it into like the standard way of stand a way of training?
Yeah, I mean, there's different ways to skin a cat, isn't there? I mean, like Jake, for instance, probably does sort of ping out sort of 60 to 80 to, I don't know, 90 mile a week, whereas I only do sort of 10 to 20 mile, average sort of 15 mile a week. But that has to be taken with a pinch of salt because I do cross train like an absolute animal. And I'd argue that I'm probably the best. I believe I cross train better than anyone else in the world in my event. And I would, in fact, I'd strongly bet myself and say that I work harder than all of the other guys. I just can't do it underfoot. And so I still do. So while they'll do a 15 mile run, I just take the elliptical out for an hour or two. And my challenge is that I have to keep up with my group on the bike. So it's actually helped my coaching relationship with my coach, because he cycles while I elliptical, and the elliptical is like a weird contraption. It's like a cross trainer on wheels. It weighs about 24 kg. It's an absolute lump to get up a hill. And it's hard work, and it's probably about 33% harder than cycling, which levels it out with when I go out with the group. And my challenge is just to hang on to them for as long as I possibly can. And of late, because the rides have been getting so long, I haven't been able to hold on to them as much. But I know that I'm getting a workout, because I often, what's known in like cycling terms, I often bunk all the time, and I push myself so hard, I just get to the point where I just start seeing stars, I start shaking and the rest of it. And so then I've learned about fueling on the bike and stuff like that. So I'm definitely working just as hard. It's just my training takes different form, and you don't necessarily have to run big mileage, which is why a lot of us athletes get injured. And now I'm a cross training convert that competes at the high level, I guess.
That's quality. So is most of the cross training on the elliptical then, or is it, do you do other stuff as well?
No, I mix it up. I mix it up on the bike. So I tend to, on a session day, I'd do my session, gym, and then I'd get on the bike, I'd cycle. Because I like to, cycling's, it's quite good just to really get a hard hit. And whilst most guys would go for an easy jog, I'll just spank the bike and just really hit it hard. And then on my days where I'm just cross training, that would just be elliptical. And that's just like, it's running without the impact. So I'm still getting the same motion of the running. I'm not getting the arm movement, but I'm embracing my core, it's weight bearing. But I just don't get the thuds through the ground. So I'm getting everything you get. I don't quite get the range that you get when you're running, but I'm getting everything else. And I can almost guarantee that I'm probably working my aerobic system harder than everybody else, because I'm always so hard. So I mean, there's different ways to do it. And I think if you, especially marathon runners, I'm surprised it's not used by them more, because they ping out some serious mileage, and the trauma their bodies sort of take is insane. And it's only due to sort of the recent technology that's sort of really helping, like the cushioning that trainers are offering now, that's probably helping athletes. But I mean, prior to that, I'm surprised they weren't using cross training methods more, rather than pinging out hundreds of miles a week, because it definitely helps. I think
you're right. I think it could be a badge of honor for some runners, kind of, you know, saying, oh yeah, I've put in together, you know, 80, 90, 100 mile weeks, and actually not potentially thinking about other avenues that you can get fit with. But I think it's really refreshing to hear you talk about that. I think that's great.
I've seen a woman on one in Battersea Park, and they look so hard. I don't know how she navigates that thing. Like, I'm so impressed that you're on that for hours, because she, I have so much respect.
They are difficult to maneuver and to ride around, but again, the beauty of it is that because you're such like an ugly object, everybody notices you, so there's an element of safety in it as well. And because you're so high off the ground, as long as you're not tackling wind, because you do become a real windbreak.
Like,
you just become somewhat of a sail. So as long as you've got the wind with you, it's quite fun. And as long as the hills aren't too big, but we've got a few hills near my house, and I've sort of conquered every hill nearby. And there's a one called Horse Block Hollow or Bar Hatch, and it gets up to about 21%, which is about as steep as you get in the UK. And I remember the first time I tried it, and I physically just couldn't get up there. And then, so that always became like one of my challenges. And I did get up there a few months ago. And I just remember thinking it was one of the hardest things I've ever done. And again, when you think about running, getting up that hill, a race is easy, and the training and the rest of it is easy. When you're hunking something that weighs 24 kg up a hill that doesn't have a low enough gear, and you're just grinding out more than you've ever done before, and you're sort of contemplating life. I think running 800 meters or 1500 meters becomes easy.
I'm picturing you rolling down a hill on one of those slowly.
Yeah, it's quite sketchy, because the wheels are so small. They're only about 20 inch or about 18, and it's so long, maneuvering is quite difficult, and it's only got V brakes, so it is quite sketchy going downhill. Especially because it's so heavy, you can pick up more speed than you would on a bicycle, because it just kind of throws you down. But it's good fun.
And your rest days when you're not cross training, are they fully rest recovery, that you're not doing anything on those days? Or are you a fan of this kind of active recovery?
It varies. It depends. So I hit cross training so hard when I was just in training camp that I'd never felt fatigue like it. And I was probably why I picked up a little bit of my injury, because I was so fatigued. I haven't experienced anything like it. And I think my rest days then were still sort of going for a walk. And we've got a little dog that we have, and I like walking him just to sort of clear my mind and be free, because we live in quite a nice part of the UK. And no, I guess every day I sort of go for that walk, even on a rest day. And but if I am completely just fried, then I'll just lie in bed all day or watch Netflix all day until my girlfriend comes home, and then I have to get up.
So I've seen videos, Elliot, of you in this van. Can you tell us about this van, the van life? What's going on?
So the van life started in 2018, and there's good and bad to it. So I had this sort of idea where I wanted to, I don't know why, I just really wanted, I grew up camping, for context. So I grew up always camping and doing all sort of the outward like activities, and like canoeing, kayaking, sailing. We would go up to Scotland quite often, and we'd walk and we'd just get lost. And then we'd go camping and we'd take the bikes and we'd just disappear forever. And I've always really enjoyed that lifestyle. And the inevitable, I wanted to buy a bus or a van and just convert it into a camper. And I did that. But the problem is that I did that during the track season, and it was probably the most stupid thing I'd ever done. But for context, I think the reason why I did do it was because I was in such a bad place. I slipped a disc in my back, and I was in a lot of pain, a hell of a lot of pain, more pain than I've ever experienced ever. I'm not sure if you ever slipped a disc, but it's
no.
And I it was over in the Commonwealths, in Brisbane, and the Gold Coast. And I'd never experienced pain like it. And I think I was just in such a bad way. I had this idea in my head and I was running with it. And because I decided to race with a slip disc. I was in a bad place. So I came back and I was like, I'm buying this van just to sort of, I think I've probably done it to try and cheer myself up. So we bought this disability bus that came over from Northern Ireland. And this really small Irish guy drove it over, because I didn't actually have a license for it, because it was a 4-ton vehicle, so I needed a special lorry license for it. Converted the van, in short, I converted it, put like a full king size bed, there was a fridge, there's a cooker, there's solar on the roof, there's electric, I've got an inverter, there's a sink, there's a full shower, there's a full composting toilet, every amenity you have in the house I have in the van, bar a washing machine. And wow. So it had all the creature comforts that you can dream of. I mean, I could even do my ironing in there if I wanted to, from the solar on the roof. So I had a big enough battery bank, and it went from a trip around Europe with some friends to moving in there for 6 months, and then I lived in it for 6 months. But the novelty wears off. I think when you live in a van and you haven't got, unless you've got land, because I was in the Brighton area, I think the novelty of it was great for the first like few months. And then after a while, you're like, I probably need to get back in the house, because if I'm trying to be a professional athlete, I can live in a van after when my career is done. But for now, I probably should get the focus back on where it needs to be.
That's literally Rick's dream. You've literally described Rick's dream.
Yeah, living near Brighton in a van. I can definitely get on board with that. That's good.
It's, and I had a 17-day turnaround for because when as athletes we have like what's called Adams, and it's like a passport where you have to update for anti-doping. So I had 17 spots with GPS coordinates. So I'd have to give my GPS coordinates and then like a short description and stuff with exactly where I was. And I had a 70-day turnaround. So if you ever need advice or want advice as where to spot, I can show you some of the best spots in and around Brighton.
Thank you very much. If you set off now, do you reckon you could probably get to Tokyo in the van, couldn't you? Just about time.
I guess so. Yeah, I mean, it'd be a long old drive, but quite a few ferries to catch. But yeah, possible.
Could we quickly talk about Tokyo? Because obviously, like the 800 meter indoor time was amazing. What for you qualifies as success at the Olympics? What are you hoping for?
I think quite short term when I train, and I haven't actually thought about Tokyo too much in terms of that's always the broader goal. But I'm sort of thinking about tomorrow and getting my body right for British Trials. So I think my goal now is to get fit. Tokyo's also, it's to get over the little issue I've got at the moment. But the main goal is always Tokyo. But I try my best not to think too far ahead. It's always the main goal. I'm super excited for it. I've got it as my my screensaver on my phone, so I see the track every day just as like a reminder of what I'm working towards. I'm just I guess there's an element of excitement, but I'm trying to walk before I can run, because it's still some way away, and the competition in the UK at the moment is so high that I think if you think too far ahead, then you might just get caught lacking, if you like.
It's an amazing crop of middle distance runners, both men and women. Do you think there's any reason why we are enjoying such a sort of golden period for British middle distance running at the minute?
Yeah, I hope it does become golden. It's not quite there yet, because none of us have actually won a medal or done anything really, besides a few quick times from a few of us. There's nothing really to note to say that it's quite that area yet. But I think we're definitely edging there. And there's a real diverse mix, because, I mean, I'm 26, and then you've got a few others that are going down to the age of 19. So it's going to be, by the sounds of it, if it keeps work going like this, it will be, because I plan on running for the next 5 years minimum. I mean, I've got another four good years based on my age. So I plan on being around for a good 5 or 6 years. So they're not going to shrug me off anytime soon. So I'm going to make them work for it. I don't know why it suddenly happened. I mean, I guess my issue why I didn't perform when I was younger was largely because I spent so many days on the sideline that I could never compete. So I was never quite there, and I sort of figured out what works for me. And I guess this new crop that's suddenly just emerged. And I mean, some of us have been around for a while, like myself, Jamie and Dan Rowden. We're all sort of ranging from 23 to 26. So we're all sort of, I guess you could say, established. And I guess we're all hungry, and it's just come at a time where, and I think when you have one person running well, it brings on the next, and then that brings on the next, and then that hunger sparks, and then we're all just realizing that we're not running for second and third place now. We're going to be contenders. We're going to have to be brave enough to run from the front and run hard and forget about everything else and just win the race. Like, we can't settle for second best anymore, because second's not good enough, and second's not going to get you anywhere in life. Nobody ever remembers the guy who came second. They only ever remember the guy who won it.
Can we talk about footwear? What are you training in at the moment? What are you racing in? Do you think what's on your feet makes a big difference?
Yeah, I think so. I'm a big fan of, so I've changed up my footwear a lot. And I think that's also contributed towards why I'm getting injured less, because the trainers that Nike have now with the cushioning, they just, the impact's greatly reduced, and you're no longer taking like the pounding on your legs anymore. I think that definitely contributes towards consistency. So at the moment I like wearing Zoom Flies. I like the Tempos, Next Percent. And I like my spikes. I like both Dragonflies and the Victories. And I'm also testing out the Max Fly. However, I haven't had a chance to properly give them a whirl yet, but I'm quite excited to.
Would the Max Fly be the ones that, if you know, if everything goes well, they'd be on your feet in Tokyo?
I think so, yeah. I like an aggressive spike, but I also don't like a spike that's too, like, I like cushioning, so I want to know that I can do a session in them without feeling like my calves are going to snap. And the Max Fly, a cushion whilst being aggressive, and I think when you marry the two together, it kind of gives you something that you can actually perform in and actually go and do the same the following day without having to take a day off or two. I think it's edging that way. So either it will be the Max Fly or the Victory, I think. I ran in the indoors in the Victory, but I was always looking for something slightly more aggressive, especially when you're running from the front. You kind of want to be efficient. You don't want to be sort of, you don't want any wasted energy, and you want to sort of propel yourself forward and you want to move forward. And that's kind of, I guess, the stiffer the spike, the in theory, if your body can handle it, the quicker you can go.
Can we quickly talk about that remarkable indoor 800 meters? Was it one of those races where everything just clicked? Did you know how kind of remarkable it was in the moment, or was it a kind of shock for you when you saw the time at the end?
Yeah, I was going through an aura of invincibility, I think, through that period, and because I laid down the foundations quite early, and I was sort of running 1:45.5, and I was feeling, my first race I opened in 1:45.5, which is pretty quick indoors to open in that time. It's normally what you run towards like mid or towards the end of your indoor campaign. And I opened in that, and I remember thinking, that's my first race indoors. And I was still very comfortable. So I knew that I was going to pop something big, because I always shift about 2 seconds from what I open with. And that's just what I normally do. And I guess it was funny, because that evening before that race, I was sort of getting the shakes in bed, and I thought I was getting ill. And I was like, my body was just twitching. And I was like, there was something, I wasn't sure what was going to happen that day. And I was like, I said to myself, it's going to be great or it's going to be disastrous. So I just said in my head, I may as well try and strike for great. Rather than listening to my body and actually thinking that it's going to break down, which I actually thought it was the night before, because I didn't get much sleep and I definitely felt I was borderline getting ill. I just figured there's nothing to lose. It's one of my last races indoors. It's going to be quick. The pace was luckily, it's the first race actually that the pacer actually asked me what I wanted. It was kind of like it was set up for me, if that makes any sense, which was really weird. And the guys in the race actually were looking to me and asking me what I wanted, which I'm not used to, which actually meant that there was like an element of they were happy to just sit on me and let me do the work, which I thought was great, because I was like, I want to do the work. Let me do the work. You guys can sit and ride the wave, and if you can beat me, then I'm going to make you work for it. But I was more than happy to sort of be in that position. And yeah, I knew I was in great shape. I was a bit gutted that there wasn't more races afterwards, because I knew that I was only getting quicker and quicker. I'm not saying I would have ran quicker than that, but I felt like it was a real upwards trajectory, and I sort of ran there. And my coach was like, "No, I'm shutting you down now. We don't need any more from this. The main aim is the outdoors, and once you go this high, the only way is down." And we didn't know where we wanted to get to, and we wanted to sort of experience that at the outdoor season where we have more time, because the indoor season is so limited. He just wanted to shut me down because he wanted me to perform like that sort of 2 weeks afterwards for the Europeans. So no, he made a call, and we shut down early and grabbed our money and ran, if you like. If we kind of felt like we robbed the bank and we didn't want to stay in there too long.
is there one sort of track session, and let's say this isn't on the Elliptico, just because I guess listeners are unlikely to have ready access to the Elliptico, what one running track session that you value above any other?
Probably 5 300s off 5 minutes, only because it's not about the session, it's more of a test of character, and it's a really hard session to get your head around, and most people, putting it bluntly, don't have the guts to attack the session the way you're supposed to. Whereas I always know that this session's not about times, it's about effort. And it's literally eyeballs out from the get-go. And that's whenever I do that session, I know that, because anybody can run quick when you're relaxed and when it's going good, but I always know that I always get to the third rep in that session and suddenly I'm questioning everything. And the fourth rep is a complete write-off, and the fifth rep is almost like you physically can't walk to get onto the line. And I always think that if you attack the first two reps and you run them like they're your last two reps and you're flat out, the last three reps, yeah, they're going to hurt, but it's all you're doing is testing your character. And for me, I always do that just to know that session will always hurt a million times harder than a race. So that, which is why I always say the training's the hard part, the racing's the fun part. I mean, racing hurts, but it doesn't hurt anywhere near as much as training does if you do it right. And I think if you want to put in that work for the race itself, then you've almost missed the boat, because the race, it's only one rep really. You only have to sort of dig in for the last 40 seconds of the final sort of lap. But besides that, when you're talking about training and those 5 300s, boy, that's a whole different kettle of fish, because you've got time to break and reset and then hurt yourself some more, and then you have to repeat that again. And it's horrible. It's pretty tough.
Elliot, thanks so much for making the time to speak with us on the podcast. It's absolutely great to hear about your running journey and the kind of unusual training techniques that are really working for you. And we wish you all the best of luck for your running in the summer, and hopefully lots of success at Tokyo as well.
Awesome. Thank you.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
So that brings us to the end of this week's Runner's World podcast. A huge thanks to our guest, Elliot Giles, and to you, of course, for listening.
You can subscribe to 3 issues of Runner's World for just £5. Head over to hearstmagazines.co.uk/runnersworldpodcast to get this exclusive listener offer.
You can listen to the Runner's World UK podcast on Acast, iTunes and all of your favourite podcast apps. Just search Runner's World UK and make sure you click subscribe. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favourite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.